Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for coming. My name is Yulai Shamiloglu. I'm chair of the Central Asian Studies Program. And so on behalf of the good folks at CRECA, Ted Gerber and Jennifer Tischler, and Jennifer, I believe, is under the weather, I'd like to thank you all for coming. Before I introduce our speaker, I'd just like to point out that the semester is slowly coming to an end. I don't know if it's time to count the weeks yet, but there are a few more activities coming up, and there are flyers for additional CRECA activities by the door. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome to Madison Professor Jeff Sahadeo, who's an assistant professor of political science and European and Russian studies at Carleton University in Ottawa in Canada. So Professor Sahadeo has his BA from Simon Fraser, his MA from Carleton, his PhD from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And Professor Sahadeo is known to many of you as a specialist in Russian and Central Asian history. He has a series of works dealing with Russian colonialism, with the various topics, and most recently he is author of Russian Colonial Society in Tashkent, 1865 to 1923, which was published by Indiana University Press in 2000. And my pro-seminar in Central Asian history will actually be studying that work in a few weeks, and so we're very excited to have you here and for everybody to have a chance to meet you and talk to you. And he also is the co-editor, along with our good friend Russell Zanka. You must have met it at Urbana then. Yes, you were. Now I explain it. Now that I realize that you studied in Urbana. So together with Russell Zanka, he's editor of Everyday Life in Central Asia, Past and Present, which also appeared in 2007 with IU Press. So 2007 was a really, really good year for Central Asian studies, thanks to Professor Sahadeo. So in general, his other interests include diaspora, migration, and empire in Eastern Europe and Asia. He works on issues of colonialism, nationality, frontiers, and borders in relations of power, and the creation of identities and state. He's done extensive work in Uzbekistan and other places, and he teaches courses on the eastward expansion of the European Union, but I was expecting he would say Russia there, but also Russia, the eastward expansion of Russia. And today he'll be addressing the topic of being black in Soviet and post-Soviet Russia, identity, adaptation, and racism. So thank you very much, and please join me in welcoming Professor Sahadeo.
Thank you all, and thanks for having giving up an hour and a half of your of a beautiful Thursday afternoon in order to come and hear me speak. I look forward to giving this talk and enlightening you, or perhaps provoking discussion at least, on an issue that's close to my heart in the contemporary era as well as the historical one. What I'll be doing this afternoon is telling you two different but inextricably intertwined stories, overviews of a project born from my own experience as an evolving scholar in Russian and Soviet history. When I first traveled to Moscow as a beginning MA student in 1992, my strongest impression was the city's multinational character. On the central streets of Moscow, I saw darker-skinned people from across Asia, Africa, rubbing elbows with Russians, Balts, and Europeans. After a brief 10-year foray into my dissertation and first book, I decided to focus on Soviet citizens from the Caucasus, Central Asia, and eastern regions of the Russian-Soviet Federated Socialist Republic, the RSFSR, the hundreds of thousands of Tatars and tens of thousands of Buryats, Chechens, Georgians, Azeris, Uzbeks, Tajiks, and others who came to major Russian cities in the decades following World War II. There, they studied at institutes of higher learning, worked as professionals, toiled in factory labor, or traded in markets. Russians denigrated them as blacks, or chorny, a term that, if linked to physical appearance, might refer to hair instead of skin color. And how and where else can Caucasians be black? But this happens in Russia. On my more recent trips, Slavic faces dominate the central streets of St. Petersburg and Moscow. Even as statistics show, a far larger population of blacks now than during Soviet times. The surface or street-level contradiction can easily be resolved, however, with one look behind or one peek behind a construction site wall. Estimates in Moscow range right now from anywhere from 300,000 to 3 million blacks in the city of Moscow and Moscow region, part of at least 5 million in Russia overall, making the country second only to the United States as a destination for labor migrants. I'll argue that this combination of reduced visibility and higher numbers stems from a complicated Soviet inheritance, as well as a strengthening global pattern of south-north migration. Economic misery at home has left young men and women with little choice but to gamble their health and their lives in increasingly xenophobic Russian cities. One of the first publications that I picked out as I started to study this project was called Moscow, a Capital for Everyone. It was published as a glossy in 1982 and part of a Soviet official effort to selectively trumpet integration of 100-plus national groups alongside students and workers from the developing world and African Americans seeking to escape racial prejudice in the West. These are a couple of interwar images of the Friendship of Nations, or Druzhba Narodov. You can see here various hues of people from the Caucasus and Central Asia giving their presence to Stalin. And this is, I believe, Fran's cover of Fran Hirsch's book, again, depicting the friendship of peoples. At the same time when, of course, the Nazi state was preaching racist division, the socialist state was preaching a multinational harmony. Interesting contact among socialist citizens was to harmonize ways of life, with intermarriage being the ultimate proof of the Soviet merger of nations. In this book, however, Moscow, a Capital for Everyone, it was only Slavs, or perhaps people from the Baltic states, maybe Ukrainians as well, who smiled from the book's pages. Brief mentions of citizens from Asian regions of the USSR or outside of it were limited for those who came to study, on work exchanges, or to organize cultural festivals. Soviet migration policy limited entrance to its showcase cities of Leningrad and Moscow to select non-Europeans for whom an invitation would be a symbol of prestige. Some Soviet Asian migrants might remain in particular professions, but most would return home to transmit new skills as well as values of loyalty and patriotism to the center. Now, in many ways, these strategies recall those practiced by Great Britain and France with their colonies in the interwar period, or in fact, as anyone like myself who has had a J-1 visa can attest to, the contemporary United States in its effort to bring intellectuals here. Other citizens of the Caucasus and Central Asia arrived as temporary workers, or so-called lemichiki, after the limited permit, or limitnaya propiska, that they received. Soviet employers received permission to issue these limited versions of residence permits, and a resident permit was required by everyone for legal residence in Leningrad and Moscow to fill jobs that the local population considered unattractive. So not only Soviet Asians, but rural Russians came and took these permits, good for 1 to 3 years and tied to a specific place of employment. And by the end of the Soviet Union, about 15% of its workforce were these so-called lemichiki. Soviet Asian migrants found no national schools, cultural organizations, or periodicals, the result of a 1937 decision aimed at promoting Russian superiority in the RSFSR. These restrictions were largely accepted by migrants as a part of the price paid to live, according to one informant, in the center of our part of the world. Even a temporary stay in Leningrad or Moscow greatly enhanced opportunities for professional advancement. As well as the prestige of degrees from Leningrad and Moscow, migrants noted the liberty of study and work environments freer from intellectual censorship and with greater access to materials published either in the West or across the Soviet Union. Access to consumer goods in Leningrad and Moscow was significantly better than at home. Many grew attached to the vitality of urban life, to opera, theater, museums, which were available not only to those who constituted the educated strata, but to every Moscovite and Leningrader. In interviews, therefore, it's not surprising that migrants recalled intense competition to enter Leningrad and Moscow. Connections to officialdom could pave the way to a coveted slot, but many of the about 50 blacks whose oral histories compose a large part of this study One of them, a self-admitted scared country boy from rural Tajikistan, claimed that their enthusiasm and drive, as well as their high grades, were key in allowing them to enter the two closed cities. Enthusiasm characterized the mood of those beginning new lives in the so-called two capitals of the USSR. Many of these arrival stories stress the welcome they received. According to Juma Boyasoyev, arriving in Leningrad in 1983, I have the quote here, we approached one man and asked him to give us directions. I guess this guy saw we were from out of town, and instead of just telling us, drove us all the way there from the airport, through the city, all the way to our dormitory. The whole trip took about an hour. He wouldn't even take the money we offered him. He just said he wanted to help. Can you believe it? We asked for directions, and he took us all the way there. Now, before going further, I should mention that I'm acutely aware of the nostalgia for the Soviet time that many of these informants stress, particularly given the racism that I'll be talking about in the second half of this. The idea of druzhba narodov, the friendship of people, again, this is a fountain in one of the economic fairs in Moscow dedicated to it, was seen by many of these blacks as a reality, something that the state preached and the population followed. But what struck me the most, in fact, in asking my informants about their initial experiences was how that they were used to frame a narrative of their entire migrant life in Leningrad and Moscow. One Georgian who went on to great success in Moscow recalled to me that the first time I went to Moscow, I stood on Red Square and was overjoyed. The Kremlin, the mausoleum, it was a very patriotic feeling for me. Others recalled receiving impolite stares on public transportation, or in one case, being beaten up by a drunk outside of Moscow, a Moscow train station. For most, however, the most difficult adaptation was the weather, the cold, the short winter days, and the dampness. Gender and sex also played important roles in Soviet Asian adjustments to Russian life. To see women smoking and drinking, bearing their arms and legs in public, constituted an initial shock, but for many it appeared as a sign that, in their words, they had arrived in Europe. Abdul Halimov, one of my informants, echoed a popular belief among men anyways, brightening up as he talked to me about this, that Russian girls prefer non-Russians. I said, when people like us, he meant people from Central Asia and the Caucasus, came from out of town, all the girls wanted to know us and treated us very well. Now, as I was telling David and some other people there, I'm not sure to what extent to believe these stories or not, but it's a popular myth in Russia among Muscovites as well as outsiders that foreigners tended to be quite attractive to Russian women in the late Soviet period. So in the end, Soviet Asian migrants saw their transition as one to a completely different life, but one that could be managed with little difficulty. Most arrived with strong Russian language skills, the byproduct of a Soviet education. For official migrants, the educational institute or workplace handled registration and provided accommodation. This is Moscow State University. Again, something that would impress, and many of the migrants recalled they lived in dormitories in one of these wings as being a sign of their newfound prestige and upward mobility in the Soviet system. So there was a real deep belief that they were now able to realize dreams of progress and advancement. As one Tajik migrant stated, even though I was born in Tajikistan, I think it would have been much more difficult to get used to living in a place like Mongolia or Japan. For me, Europe has always been closer. Well, maybe here is not completely Europe, but the style of life is European. One feature differentiating multi-ethnic Soviet cities from those elsewhere in Europe was a lack of ethnic enclaves. State-assigned dormitories and housing blended national groups, and this became part of the mythology of the Soviet era. Feelings of nostalgia flowed from interviewees as they proudly listed off the backgrounds of their dorm mates. According to one, said Russians, Ukrainians, Uzbeks, Turkmen, Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, Azerbaijanis, Armenians, Georgians, Chechens, Dagestanis, Belarusians, Tajiks, Buryats, Tatars, Azerbaijanis, and so on. Maybe I'm forgetting others. Dormmates helped each other to become city people, all the while keeping a sense of their background, sharing cuisine and stories of their homelands. In Lemichik dorms, a sense of common purpose to obtain a permanent residence permit pushed migrants to work together. One dormitory for young women featured an official responsible for cultural growth who gave out distributed tickets to cultural events, museums, theater, the opera, for free to some of these young women working in fruit and flower markets. Along with a sense of community, however, came distance from the established local population. Racism surfaced in Moscow in the early 1960s with a series of attacks and a few murders of African students. I haven't found yet any incidents of violence against other Soviet citizens. And some of the informants that I talked to say that people who had brown skin instead of black were judged upon their loyalty to their particular homelands to the Soviet Union. And one informant said that, you know, even Russian racists knew which African or which sort of North African countries were loyal or were in the Soviet sphere or were not in the Soviet sphere, and you get beat up if you were from a Western, pro-Western African country and not if you were from a pro-Soviet one. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but this was his story. Personal experiences of racism vary actually quite wildly among my interviewees. Some claim simply that there was not and could never be racial prejudice given the ideology of friendship of peoples and the strength of the state. I asked one informant about questions about any ethnic relations and potential ethnic tensions, and I was accused that even my questionnaire could be considered a falsified history because nothing like this could have ever happened. Others reported almost daily incidents, with one Uzbek saying he left Moscow in 1997 so he would no longer, in his words, feel like an Untermensch. One Kyrgyz woman remembered her first encounter with university cleaning staff who greeted her and the others with the term panarikhali. It took me a while to figure out the meaning and the impact of this term, perhaps best expressed by author Anya Ulinich in a novel about a woman of mixed Russian-African ancestry. So the single word panarikhali means they arrived over a period of time in large enough masses to be an annoyance. Here the abuse is compact and efficient. Two prefixes do the word of an entire sentence. Suddenly Sasha finds herself missing Brooklyn. And I'll leave out the rest of the sentence because David told me I'm being taped, so I can't I can't use that word, but we have it up there. Panarikhali joined black or charny as major racist epithets in Soviet Russia, alongside others such as monkey and those that translate roughly as black snout or black ass. I'm still trying to trace the origin of the word charny, which seems to appear post-World War II in the Soviet lexicon, and focused uniquely on Soviet citizens, rather than the term negre, or negro or nigger, depending on how it was used, the epithet given to black Africans. Soviet Asian incorporation to Slavic host societies in the end became a highly personal experience, conditioned by national and class background on the one hand, and a desire to succeed and overcome perceived or actual hurdles in order to benefit from the privileges of being at the heart of the Soviet Union on the other. Early, mostly blue-collar Tatar arrivals to post-war Leningrad clustered in clan groups and avoided mixing outside of the workplace. Prevented from living side by side, they would rent duchess or cottages together in the summertime. Many professional migrants from Central Asia and the Caucasus, on the other hand, chose not to seek out fellow kin or co-ethnics, preferring to associate with their multinational study or work collectives. Integration, even among informants, did not appear to alter feelings, however, of loyalty towards a national homeland, hindering an official goal of migration as a primary factor in the eventual development of a unified Soviet people. One survey of Muscovite Armenians showed really no change in degree of national loyalty to the nation according to how long they had lived in Moscow, whereas first-generation Armenians, understandably, were more comfortable in their local language and had just come, had a very strong sense of identification. Even second-generation Armenians who had spoke Russian uniquely still said that they were equally as proud to be so-called full Armenian, believing that a common fate bound them to their homeland. Others saw their own culture as a superior to a Russian one that featured, according to them, lack of respect towards elders, ignorance, drunkenness, and promiscuity. In an early 1990s Moscow State University survey, clear majorities of national groups, including those in mixed marriages, preferred to rear their children according to national traditions. The Georgians at 90% and the Uzbeks at 80%, were the ones who were the most tied to this idea. A desire to hold on to their national backgrounds, even when in Moscow, and most of these national backgrounds, I should mention, are products of the Soviet state. They do use Soviet categories, ones that were created in the 1920s and 30s, led to difficult decisions. Soviet Asian migrants pondered whether to seek, through a bribe or through official channels, to have their own children born in Leningrad or Moscow declared ethnically Russian on their passport, which might, in their view, lead either to a greater potential for career advancement or less opportunity for any prejudice to be visited upon them. But this decision, as well as the naming of the child, was quite a charged process as parents began to calculate how skin and hair color would evolve over their lifetime. Tata, a respondent, said that their greatest fear was that a child's name and a child's nationality on their passport would not correspond to how the child looked. So if you had a child declared ethnically Russian, but that child looked dark and looked like a Tatar, that would be exposing the child to, in fact, a double-edged prejudice, and that Russians were very uncomfortable with people who said they were Russian but did not look Russian. It would be better if they were simply a Tatar. Professional satisfaction for almost all, however, more than compensated for these tensions. One migrant characterized or credited his desire to stay in Moscow to the scale of civil aviation projects that he could work on at an all-union level. Everything in the Soviet system funneled up to Moscow. They would get final approval on large projects and would be able to initiate projects at will. He linked his success not only to dedication and skill, but also on his ability to outwork the local Russian population. And I'll give a quote when asked if he felt from the start that he could make a career in Moscow. It's a bit too big for a slide, so I'll just read it out. He said, "Yes, may I be a little bit immodest? I was hardworking, I didn't drink, and those two qualities set me apart from others. This is one of the negative qualities of the Russian population. After work, they must relax well, and by this I mean drink. Well, of course, not only Russian people like to relax and unwind after work, all people like to do this, but you have to know your limits. It's one thing to have a mug of beer after work and go home. It's another to get so drunk you don't know how to get home. Unfortunately, this type of behavior was frequent with Russians. I also never complained about anything at work. If they gave me extra work, I didn't say anything. I just did it." This narrative of working as hard as or often harder than the local population, of course, permeates stories of migrant success globally. Though the national myth, of course, of the hardworking migrant in the United States is more prominent when you think of European migration in the early 19th century than when you think of migration today. A number of these migrants who achieved professional success in Soviet Leningrad and Moscow now perform important functions for the post-Soviet migratory wave. They provide advice and assistance for friends, relatives, and villagers who have come since the collapse. A number have formed national diaspora organizations working with a different strata of migrants whose presence is a result of a different Soviet legacy, one that I'll turn to for a few minutes before discussing the contemporary situation. With Soviet planning decisions, I argue, that created the structural and demographic inequalities that have opened the floodgates to today's migratory wave. Ignoring warnings, Lenin and subsequent Soviet leaders continued to see the South as a pool for raw resources, whose goods would be manufactured by Russian proletariat, the ostensible backbone of the revolution. So the Soviet system, as many of you know, operated almost on a hub and spoke, where materials developed raw goods, especially in Central Asia, and rough manufacture in the Caucasus would then be undergo final work in Russia and then sent back to the Republic. So everything worked around the RSFSR. Replicating European colonial patterns as well, Slavic administrators took charge of the coal, oil, hydroelectric, and other resources in the periphery, seeing the peoples of the Caucasus and Central Asia largely as fruit, grain, or cotton farmers. By the 1970s, Soviet planners realized that rapid demographic growth in Central Asia, almost 4 children per family, was outpacing employment opportunities. The situation worsened as the productivity of cotton fields fed on nutrient-killing pesticides declined. One solution was to offer training and employment to fill labor needs in the industrialized RSFSR, where population growth was in decline. But Soviet recruitment campaigns to bring Central Asians, and primarily the goal was to take them out to the Far East, where a lot of industrial and raw resources were being developed, didn't work for a number of different reasons, mainly economically. Some talk about at the time there was a cultural thesis going on that Central Asians would never leave their homeland because of their Islamic background and their attachment to family, which is maybe contradicted a little bit by what's going on today, that we can talk about that later. But there were clear economic disincentives to moving. Collective farm managers and the planning system, the Soviet planning system, allowed employers to hoard labor, and wage differentials were not between agriculture and industrial work were not sufficient to draw rural Central Asians away from their homeland. Now, how long the Soviet Union, had it survived, could have continued to support, in effect, subsidizing a highly growing population with lack, with no real economic opportunities provided for them, is an open question. But I argue, however, that the fact that this, the Soviet Union, 1970s and 1980s, was continuing to underinvest in these peripheral regions would have meant that it eventually would have had to deal with the same problems that are confronting successor governments right now. Now, at the same time that migrant policies or efforts to move migrants from Central Asia were not working, migrants from the Caucasus area who were not targeted, residents of the Caucasus area who were not targeted for migration, did start to come in increasing numbers in Russia. Villagers began to concentrate as state supervision over collective farms weakened all their production on private plots, which they began to drive up to Moscow and to Leningrad to sell. And if some of you may recall, during the Soviet system, the way that travel costs worked, and it was actually affordable, or you could make a profit by flying from Tbilisi or Moscow with all the melons you could carry, selling them on the streets of Moscow, and then just going back the same day or the day afterwards. So the system allowed for a lot of different trade and living even in Moscow without official permission because the desire for fresh fruit and flowers as well was very strong in Moscow. But the presence of these migrants from the Caucasus, Azeris, Georgians, in the 1970s, at the same time when far-right movements were increasing in strength across Europe, sparked an intensified round of Russian xenophobia. Ethnic jokes began to appear focused on the Georgians, whose involvement in dirty capitalist trade sullied not only themselves, but also their pure white Russian hosts. Glasnost offered unprecedented opportunities for minorities to organize, but also for racism to penetrate popular media. A fascist group in 1989 condemned the mongrelization of the Russian nation on a Moscow television station. The publication of the 1989 census was a crucial point as it began, as it showed the Slavic populations barely clinging to majority status in the census and being rapidly outpaced in growth by those from the Caucasus and Central Asia. And it's at that point that the Russian right-wing press in the Glasnost era, which had, until that time had been largely anti-Semitic, and the Jews were the target of their racist images, switched their racist language over to peoples of the Caucasus and Central Asia. As shortages and uncertainties worsened during perestroika, popular opinion expressed significant discomfort with minorities. A Moscow State University survey in 1992 reported that 46% of native Muscovites reported negative feelings towards Azeris, 40% towards Chechens, and 30% towards Georgians. Only 8% reported negative feelings towards Jews. Now, unprecedented waves of migration, now to turn to the post-Soviet period, turned these sparks of racism into a conflagration. As a surge of hydrocarbon prices fueled the Russian economy's rise, growth in the Caucasus and Central Asia, with the notable exception of Kazakhstan, stalled. Residents lost faith in local politicians and could not replace the labor of highly skilled Slavic administrators, and professionals who returned home. Economic divergence intensified in the 2000s. To use one example, the World Bank calculates that about 30% of Uzbekistan's population, about 7 million people, are unable to meet their basic food needs. In rural Central Asia, salaries average about $10 monthly, and about 35% of the rural population is unemployed. Russia quickly emerged as a favored labor migration destination, as travel required no visa, transport costs were low, and diaspora connections were already established. Here's a few images of some of the so-called black population in Moscow. A shrinking population in Russia as well left over a million construction and industrial jobs unfilled. Salaries in Russia average about $200 a month, so 20 times what they do in Central Asia, with those in Moscow particular being much higher. It appears now, and I don't have time to go into the detailed statistics, but roughly a third of the labor forces of the Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Azerbaijan are in Russia right now. Remittances from Russia total about $10 billion a year, constituting more than a third of the gross domestic product of these post-Soviet states. Now, the Russian state has played a complex role in this migration, tacitly realizing a need for labor, but feeding and feeding off of nationalist rhetoric. Travel remains visa-free, but despite a constitutional court ruling, propiska regulations remain in force in major Russian cities, and a work permit is required for residents. In 2007, as efforts were made to streamline registration and work authorization procedures for migrants to fill yawning gaps in the labor force, President Putin was introducing limits to migrant labor in economic sectors like private trade, where the Russian population was ostensibly being driven out. Judicial authorities alternate between crackdowns on racist and skinhead gangs and the issuing of light sentences for hooliganism in the case of murders of residents from the Caucasus and Central Asia. In one case, a hooliganism sentence of 3 to 5 years, I think, was given out to someone guilty in the murder of a 9-year-old Tajik girl in St. Petersburg. The police, credited by so many Soviet-era migrants as preventing street-level racism, now prey on the newcomers. Ubiquitous document checks are pretext to theft or extortion, whether the migrant has legal registration or not. According to one worker, I was walking on the street and had 15,000 rubles on me because I had gotten paid. Four policemen stopped me and took me to the station. They tore up my registration and took my money. They were even firing me with a toy gun. I told them that I would go to the embassy and file a complaint. Then they decided to hold me for 2 days. They beat me with truncheons. First one would hit me, then the second. On the third day in the evening, they let me go. And after I said I would not complain. So abuse, violence, and the potential of murder compose a significant part of the migrant experience of post-Soviet blacks. The decapitation of a Tajik migrant whose head was found outside a Moscow government, I think this was in December or January, along with a threatening note aiming to kill or to blame any Russian who allows migrants to come in to Moscow, represents a growing trend. Moscow's Sova Center, which tracks racist violence, counted at least 82 race-based murders and 348 violent attacks in 2008, although chronic underreporting or misreporting of such crimes means that the numbers are likely significantly higher than that. Widespread xenophobia, I would argue, mounted, particularly following the 1999 Moscow apartment bombings, which were blamed on Chechens, and subsequent terror attacks that hardened attitudes against all blacks. The Moscow anti-immigrant group Miestnia, or Locals, which raids markets to look for illegal migrants, has 150,000 members and is supported by the governor of the Moscow region. Pollsters found that 75% of respondents in telephone interviews across the country were supportive of restrictive measures against foreigners in the sphere of retail trade. According to one Russian farmer, you just try to monkey with the rules of the market. There, everything has been bought up by Asia. Neither a granny with her parsley nor a farmer with his own potatoes can get in. Most recently, the youth wing of Putin's United Russia has announced it will begin hunting illegal migrant workers at construction sites as part of its new campaign called Our Money for Our People. Such comments and actions are fodder for a sensationalist media, which plays on and feeds well-established perceptions of economic domination. A racist political ad, one that was actually banned in 2005, but is mild by today's standards, is a good place to start with this image. These are the blacks, the southerners. So clean the trash from our city. This ad was actually by Rodina, which is a party, nationalist party, that was banned for participation in the Moscow elections in 2005, but then afterwards, subsequently, was folded into Putin's United Russia Party. This is a joke in one of the Moscow newspapers. Play on an old Russian fable, if any of you know it. Once upon a time, there was a plain old Moscow potato that turned into a gold potato. Then there were simple tomatoes that turned into gold. Next, there were ordinary eggs that turned into gold. How? Your answers are eagerly awaited by the Moscow-Azerbaijani diaspora. Other newspaper images, again, show focus on the market. Who is the master of Russian markets? You can see the way they counterpose images of most likely Azeris here to the poor Russian pensioners. Be careful, cholera. Again, an idea of non-Russians bringing disease into the market. This is probably the most popular trope these days. The headline, Farewell, Microbe on a Stick. You can see the way that they're trying to portray these southerners from the Caucasus. They're collectively and ruthlessly dehumanized, as you can tell, depicted as locusts descending upon the city in exponentially increasing waves and clustering in overcrowded apartments, where, in the words of Moskovsky Komsomolets, one of the newspapers, they cannot be exterminated by any means. Now, swayed by such arguments and passed over in the Russian economic boom, young, relatively uneducated and underemployed or unemployed Russian youth, particularly in dingy suburbs, constitute the main force for racist gains. These are some of the suburb areas that are the most dangerous for Moscow and undergrad blacks right now. Images of some of the Russian racists or skinheads. There are about 70,000 of them now. Conservative estimates would place about 70,000, highest in the world. Well organized, they tend to use text messaging to hunt for black migrants, to set up a time and place and they'll meet and try and find somebody to beat up. They're interviewing one skinhead after attacking a guy who just came out of a bar that was considered a gay bar and asked why he did this. He said, we tried to catch some of these blacks, but they ran too fast. And so we decided to just hang outside the bar and beat up the first person that came out of it. So they troll the metros as well, looking for victims where they have them. And if you ever look on YouTube, you can call up a number of these attacks that people have videoed on their cell phones and posted there. At the same time, however, I should mention a marginal but growing anti-fascist skinhead movement in Russia, highlighted by peaceful marches and rock concerts. So at every step, migrants from Caucasus and the Central Asia face huge risks. Unscrupulous recruitment agents share stories about guaranteed high-paying jobs in Russia. charging hundreds of dollars, again, not so small fortunes, in fees, recruiters lead migrants to Russian destinations and often abandon them. Some take their passports and hand them over to employers who will treat them as slave labor. According to one Tajik, we worked from sunrise until 10 p.m. and sometimes even all night. They would turn on the spotlights at night. We did everything, pouring cement, tearing down some walls, some construction finishing work, carried sacks. After a few days, we said to them, what is this? No one promised us this. And they answered, we are not going to speak to you. We'll only speak to your speak through your supervisor. Your master sold us, sold you to us. We gave him money to go and work it off. These migrants are often locked in trailers at night with no running water and subsist on pasta, buckwheat, water provided by the employer. Strong men beat up any who rebel. In a lot of these stories, migrants are frequently not paid for the several months that they're there. Then all of a sudden a raid will occur and they'll be deported home. Special troops, special forces troops, the so-called Oman, are only glad enough to conduct raids. Businessmen tip them off so they can beat up a bunch of workers to hone their tactics. The workers get deported, then a new group comes, and the cycle repeats itself, and these workers are, this labor force is handled without any wages ever having to be paid. Some migrants, especially now given the lack of work in Moscow and St. Petersburg, have moved into shanties on distant edges, away from potential skinhead attacks, but in areas without electricity or water, and where they sort of scavenge for food. Now, cases are not so bleak for all migrants, of course. There are reasons why these people continue to come to Moscow and to St. Petersburg and other Russian cities. One Tajik nurse, who once earned $10 monthly working in a hospital where her hands often froze as she disinfected materials in icy water, now cleans offices in Moscow for $500 a month. She pays $300 for a flat, which she shares with a family, and is able to send $150 home a month, which is, of course, a fortune in those regions. One Tajik found a position as a security guard and stock boy in a flower shop in Moscow, earning $1,000 a month. This has been recently, it's been slashed by more than a half, given the economic crisis. The money is spent, the vast majority of it at home, beyond living expenses, as migrants tend to state the most common reasons for working there is to support their families, to pay for a house or a car, or in actually quite a number of cases, to pay for a big wedding, which is a huge expense among Central Asian families. And remittances have indeed changed many villages in the Caucasus and Central Asia, and even traveling through these smaller villages now, I've seen a far higher number of newer cars and construction than I have in recent years, and this is credited often to money sent back from Russia as a result of remittances. But, of course, there are not only does life in Moscow pose threats, but migrants' family life suffers, as many of these young men are married and leave home. Wives left at home in the village often lose their status. Goods are from the remittances are stolen from them. Their in-laws, their husband's family tries to control the money and take it from them. Stresses of migrant life, from experiences of racism and abuse to the fact that most are not working in their chosen professions, sleeping on floors and crammed apartments, leads to tensions in marriages and higher divorce rates. In my own interviews, female migrants in St. Petersburg, as well as those left behind, worry greatly about their husbands falling prey to a Russian woman. Blame in these cases is placed never on the man, but on the ostensible seductress, part of a larger discourse of Russian women as provocative manipulators. So unsurprisingly, post-Soviet migrants live cloistered existences. Even as my informants express positive feelings towards the Russians they work with, most are wary or downright terrified of leaving their apartments alone or at night. Frustration over the situation prompts recrimination. Well-educated Soviet-era migrants blame the newer ones who have, with their lack of skills and poor knowledge of Russian, for failing to assimilate and for making racism far more dangerous. In response, one new construction worker responded, "Why should we learn Russian? We only see them from five stories up." Many blame the Chechens and those from the North Caucasus as well for the attacks that have turned Russians against all blacks. Newer migrants maintain ambiguous feelings towards their homelands. They express a great desire to return home, missing, as did their Soviet-era counterparts, a land of sunshine and melons. But many blame local elites and politicians for poor economic situations, the poor economic situation that drove them abroad, and harbor little hope that this will be rectified in the near future. Although Kyrgyz migrants follow news from home intently, hardly any participate in the local electoral process, voting absentee at their embassy. Many new migrants are suspicious of diaspora organizations, seeing them as either patronizing or corrupt, even though there's one that I heard about that maintains its own group of retired soldiers and military officers to go and threaten Russian employers that don't pay, I think it's the Azeris, unemployed Azeris. So some of these diaspora organizations do serve a purpose. One Kyrgyz worker working in Moscow, though, typified the sense that we're just on our own. And they tend to form self-defense groups with other migrants to protect them, armed often with knives, when they go out into the city. Central Asian Caucasus governments, finally, like their Russian counterparts, have reacted with ambivalence towards the massive migratory wave. There are commissions and studies and agreements that never really amount to much. The question of whether this migration remains an ultimate benefit or detriment to sending states remains an open one. On the one hand, migration is sapping countries of their most dynamic young citizens. On the other, maybe it's better for them not to be at home when the unemployment opportunities are so limited, and they might be tempted to become involved in Islamist organizations if you're the government. On the one hand, skills and earnings gained abroad might lead to benefits once migrants return home. But on the other, most of the migrants now working in Russia are working in construction or kind of unskilled, doing unskilled labor. So the benefits that they would bring back in terms of knowledge perhaps is not quite as not quite as effective or is quite as important in terms of benefiting the sending state. Of course, and also the earnings that they give back home has led to increasing social polarization in villages between those who have migrants who are sending money back and those who do not. The current economic crisis has certainly sharpened the home government's attention, however. Official Kyrgyz figures estimate that 20% of migrants from Russia have returned already, and diaspora organizations in Moscow are telling migrants to stop coming. In Uzbekistan, figures show a stunning 90% decline in remittances between, using as a sort of benchmark, January 2008 and January 2009. The Tajik government has, not long after Barack Obama's stimulus package, has offered their own stimulus package to put people to work, though it's unclear whether they'll find the funds for this. And there's really significant worry that the Central Asian states' economies not only are suffering from unemployment, but prices have become much higher due to the economic crisis, and that migrants coming back, seeing that not only will they not get the wages in Russia, but that they'll have to pay higher prices for food, that this will be a significant source of instability in Central Asia in the fall, in the next even months. So there'll be challenging ones, of course, for governments, but also for the migrants themselves, who are losing their jobs or facing massive salary cuts. Often as providers for at least their immediate family, they have no safety net nor apparent alternate means of employment. So how long they'll remain in Russia, or how many will remain in Russia, how toxic the environment will grow, what will be left for them, these questions are all unclear. So just to conclude finally, in the collapse of the Soviet welfare state and the huge differentials in post-Soviet living standards have opened the floodgates of migration and racism. The Central Asian elites that were the most visible signs of early Soviet migration in Leningrad and Moscow have been joined by the desperate and the destitute, as well as the energetic and the entrepreneurial. Where we can't forget the Soviet legacy, however, though perhaps we should more accurately argue that this is the legacy of all modern industrial powers. The creation of a clear core and periphery has provoked similar migrations at different times worldwide. Thank you.
Thank you very much. for a great talk. Would you like to take your own question?
Sure.
Okay. If there are any questions for Professor Sahadeo?
I'll start with one. Something that you touched on, but I'd like you to think of in both the Soviet and post-Soviet context, but also the comparative perspective that you brought up at the end, is I'd say it sounds like, and intuitively I'd say, the biggest shift that has happened since the collapse of Soviet power, and really since the krach of 97, is Moscow is no longer really a magnet for intellectual and artistic elites in the old satellite states. That they've got new markets either in Turkey or in South Asia or in Europe and in North America. And what does that, in what ways has that inflected Russian encounters with the native Russian encounters with the new migrants who look more like much more like the migrants that trouble American immigration debates, and how does this what does this lack or this sort of truncated selection of immigrants, like it's basically what Russians call Yumpen coming in, what does that imply about sort of broader patterns of Russian relations with their periphery as opposed to centers like London or Paris or New York or Miami?
Right. Broad questions. The question of intellectual migration, certainly, I mean, in the Soviet period, they really had no choice given the system. Moscow and Leningrad was pretty much it. Now, I would say, you're right, that most intellectual migrants, most intellectuals that I talk to in Central Asia, their goal is to gain a grant with the Western organization, quite frankly, and either get to New York or London, or more frequently, to get Western money to stay at home. Now, part of this is also because they can get access to intellectual materials much more easily wherever they are. I had one Kyrgyz woman who couldn't face going to Moscow in the Soviet era, but even then she had to fly there every few months. She said, how can I live without books? Because the only place you could buy books was in Moscow, good academic books. So that is complete. You're right, that's a huge shift. So that strata is gone. Even if it was still there, they'd be a very small minority of the numbers who came. I was just reading an article that a Russian sociologist has, or a book that she's written on multinational Moscow, and she argues that the Soviet system, unlike, say, in London or Paris in the post-World War II era, there was no preparation for this massive wave, that they just came from nowhere and overwhelmed this idea of Druzhba Narodov, which was easy to perpetuate when everybody that the Russians saw, even if they were Central Asian in appearance or Caucasian in appearance, dressed the same, spoke Russian, and seemed more in a completely different strata. So it's showing, it's taking a society that's already in great stress with the Soviet collapse and then imposing a completely new level of migration on them. And it feeds into images. And when you look at the Soviet images of the other, it's very dual. I mean, on the one hand, there's this sort of idealized Druzhba Narodov image where, again, all these people are in their traditional costumes, but they, like this, and they would have their cultural festivals, and then they would kind of, then again, they would look like us versus people who are now on the streets. And, you know, it's not clear to me really how you can compare it to London and Paris. Certainly the fear, this idea of enclaves is a big one that keeps coming up, and that when you read the Russian press, that they're really scared of, and nobody's really sure to what extent it's actually happening. I mean, they're enclaves in the sense that in one apartment building, say, there might be, but not really in the sense that we might think of a so-called Chinatown or area that's, but this domination of the markets tends to be very pronounced. So I don't really have a set answer for that, but this flip in migration rather than a more staggered migration, whereas in London you had everybody, different strata coming sort of simultaneously. Now, there were race riots in London in the 1960s, and this is something the Soviet state was spared. I mean, there were race riots in the United States in the 1950s and 60s when sort of the first waves came up. So is this just a kind of time-delayed phenomenon, or is it something different or something more lasting, or is there something uniquely Russian about it? It's harder to tell. I mean, I'd be curious to hear what everybody else's views are. Yeah? Yeah, again, it's another huge question. And I mean, obviously the state was very active in promoting this idea of friendship of nationality. So they were able to set, and it was a very interventionist state, they were able to set policies of limiting or targeting migration and targeting levels of inter-ethnic contact so that I think what the state did in terms of everyday life, and it did rather effectively, was to segment it out so that, for example, in Central Asia, there were, if you were Russian, you were in a certain, you were working in industrial plants, or you had certain positions in the party, and if you were Central Asian, you had parallel but different paths to aspire to. So it wasn't, they tried to avoid places where economic competition would be important between nationalities. So competition didn't become ethnicized to a certain extent. Everybody had their own titular nationality. If you were Uzbek in Uzbekistan, in certain ways you were better off than if you were Russian. But if you were Russian, you were better off in other ways. So they were able to manage a policy where there weren't overt confrontations. And they were, through the media, they were able to put this very idealized image of each nation having its own place. It was inculcated in the Soviet educational system, certainly. And when I talk to people who went through Soviet schools, I mean, this idea of friendship of nations was very strongly implanted in them from a young age. And they really felt that this was important. You know, you didn't have any of these racist images in the media that you have now. You had more of these kind of idealized images. But they were could be very patronizing in some ways. And certainly when you look at images of Africans, you know, in Russian cartoons, children's cartoons on TV, they were very, you know, the sort of Sambo images. But there was a sense that we're all Soviet citizens, the ones from inside. And it was very real to, not just in Russian ethnic relations, but in peoples across the Soviet Union, Georgians and Azeris and people who I talk to, all say, I have so-and-so married. There's a lot of intermarriage was sort of encouraged as a positive step. And the sense of mixed families is a very important part of Soviet identity. How far it penetrated is not clear. I mean, I don't know if Jewish men were to have much of a place in Russian villages. For example, but the ideology was there. And so, you know, to what extent this was a artificially constructed thing or to what extent you call it a success story is not clear, but certainly the level of ethnic tension or violence was far less than it was now or than it was in Western societies in the 70s and 80s. What's that? So what happened? Well, this is what I'm trying to figure out. I mean, I think obviously it's the level of economic competition and uncertainty that was the most important factor, that the Russian population was confronted with this migratory wave at the same time that the stability of the communist system was being undermined. So they blame, there's a certain scapegoating that's going on, a certain sense that these others are, and there's a Russian narrative as well that equates capitalism with oppression by non-Russians. And this goes back to the imperial period, that Russians were dominated by foreign capital. I mean, this is something the Bolsheviks played on, either Germans or Armenians or Jews. And this has become a very strong sense. This is why you get these large sort of skinhead Aryan ideologies that have now transposed this. But the media and the state has played a large role too. I mean, Putin, after the Moscow bombings in 1999, threatening to, you know, take Chechens and rub their heads in a toilet, and this kind of inflammatory rhetoric has played a role. So there's all kinds of popular tensions that the state has decided to feed off of. I think that's that are all major reasons for this.
Go ahead. And a question. My comment is that I found it very interesting when I looked at the picture of the, quote, blacks eating watermelon and thinking about southern quotes and southern pictures of African Americans in the olden days eating the watermelon, sitting there, spitting out the seeds and all. So there was that commonality that I found there. My question is, with all of the negative perceptions about blacks, be that hair color, Africans, and I'm sure African Americans, how do you feel they perceive the election of Barack Obama as the president of the United States?
There was a racist. They had a there's racist imagery, and again the black blacks have always, not always, but there's been significant portrayal of African Americans in the way that they were portrayed here in the 1960s and 70s, these sort of big lip sample ones. And that, if you look at Russian cartoons of Barack Obama, they're like that. I haven't talked to too many Russians since Barack Obama has been elected, so I'm more guessing based on other patterns. But yeah, it's a good question. I'm just trying to think of a narrative that they've plugged into, but that's all I can really say is I have seen racist images of Barack Obama in the Russian press, but not too much of a comment on him as being somehow unfit or to lead. I think it's a different sense. He's not black in the same sense that these Soviet Asians are black. So he's intellectual, and in fact, it's been a good narrative because the Russians, for me, when I talk to Russians, and Russians typically are very sensitive to criticisms about their democratic or lack of democratic system. And when we complain about Putin's constraining of democracy, and they say, well, you Americans don't have any democracy. Clinton, Bush, and now you're going to have another Clinton, and at least we didn't have that. So we can sort of make a claim that there's some more dynamism in the Russian, in the American system. And I think they see it in a certain sense as dynamic, but there's an underlying current of racism there that's there. Others, I mean, there might be others who have had more direct contact.
I'm sorry. Well, first of all, this thing with watermelon, I apologize, you did a great job. It's just beautiful. It's just lots of stuff, but there are little small things that, I mean, they're there. A thing with a watermelon, a totally different sense. I remember this thing on TV, okay? The guys who are eating watermelon are Moscovites, they're Russians. The lady who's walking by, she's Ukrainian. If you look back, she's blonde hair, she's has this feature, she's Ukrainian, Belarusian. Those guys are Moscovites, okay? And the whole idea of this little advertisement was Moscovites were undereducated and behave like pigs. They actually claim that they are like whiter than the white people who are coming from Ukraine and Belarus. Because they are saying, понаехали тут, meaning they came, those people, this trash came over. And this Ukrainian woman is shown like very with lots of dignity, she's walking by. And those two guys are talking to those Russians, saying, she's behave yourselves. That's the meaning. You're trying to insult people who came from other places, but you behave like pigs and you're putting down Moscovites because of this. It has nothing to do with racism, absolutely.
Ma'am, I have to step up to this also.
Yes.
When you see a picture like that, with people with dark hair, eating watermelon and all, that is so stereotypical of how people that look like me and Africans, etc., are shown.
Yes,
and so maybe it was a person that was of a lighter skin, but it's still the imagery that is portrayed. There might have been a lot of different words that have gone around it. When they show Sambo, there can be beautiful words about that, but the picture that's right there is Sambo.
Okay, I'm black. Hi. That's fine.
Okay.
But you aren't an African American.
I'm black. Okay. Wait a minute. This image is correct. I agree with you. But this image comes from Uzbeks or whoever sitting at the farmer's market eating watermelons, throwing the score on the floor. That's true. That's why they turned it upside down. They showed Russians sitting there eating watermelon, doing the same thing, and accusing a, like, comer from different place of being uncivilized. That's the thing. You don't want to believe me, that's fine. Well, but that's the thing. About Obama, there was a dual attitude.
Yeah, let's just
say,
I just have another question.
I'm sorry, continue my doctor, what others, I don't want to use up the time. I have a question about a possible hierarchy among the immigrants that you categorize as being black. Is there somewhat a more accepting attitude towards immigrants from former Soviet lands than as opposed to immigrants from other parts of the continent?
Yeah, it's... I would say there is, I mean, there are different hierarchies, and the hierarchies are in flux, and have been in flux for the past several years. I mean, it used to be, as I said, in the Soviet period, there was a sense of common Soviet citizenship that played a certain role. And then within that, a sense that Georgians, Armenians, who were Christian peoples, were more accepted as professionals. And now there was a sense that they were others. And an interesting difference that I find in the Soviet era is Central Asians come are kind of patronized as almost children, like kind of naive, a sort of image of naive, unspoiled children. And, oh, isn't it nice that you want to become intellectual? Kind of pat them on the head. This one Central Asian I was talking to said that he got to high intellectual position, a professor in a university, and then went to join the kind of diplomatic Soviet embassy corps. All the Central Asians would be sent on exchanges or to Pakistan or to different areas, and all the Slavs would go to Germany. This was the way that they did it. But all the racist jokes were about Georgian traders or Chukchis, who were the sort of ethnically far northern population. So there is that hierarchy. Now it's the caucus, the people from the Caucasus were the ones who were blamed for the market chaos and stuff now. Central Asians, the Tajiks, are the ones all working in the construction industry, according to them, and are stealing jobs from Russians. But they each have different roles of like posing a danger to the Russian society. I don't know if I don't think the skinheads really are even these sort of popular. They just go and they find somebody with dark hair. They think they can. I mean, they have a sense of who's, I mean, I have a colleague of mine, Eric McGlinchey. We would look at him and we'd see the name McGlinchey, we'd think, oh, he's Scots-Irish. He's got a sharp face and all the Russians think he's a Chechen. And he's had a lot of trouble, not just with Russians coming up to him, police hassling him, but with other Central Asians saying, get away from us because you're going to cause us trouble, because you're actually more dangerous than we are. So, It's a very, anybody who looks a little bit different, it just depends on the type of people that you run into. These hunts.
Is lighter color more acceptable than darker color?
I think there's, again, it varies. I think more than the color, it's the way people are dressed and the way they look. I'm worried whenever I go to Russia. I've never had any trouble. I think people identify me, as I was saying at lunch, as an Indian or Spanish or Portuguese or something like that. So that's fine, I'll go with that. So if you can look sort of dressed, because they'll look at your shoes and they'll look at how you're dressed. But still, you never know what level these people are going to do it. But none of my colleagues who are Westerners have faced any of these issues in day-to-day experiences or with the police or something like that. But I'm always afraid if I get in the wrong metro, in the wrong car, it's difficult.
Just kind of a follow-up question to that. There's a lot also, I know, of Belarusians, Moldovans, Ukrainians, who are also working in some of these same jobs. I don't know if you had a chance to do much interviewing with those particular labor migrants, but if you did see any kind of difference there, I think that kind of follows up on this
point. Yeah. I haven't really talked to those people. I mean, it's my sense is that there is certainly a hierarchy of Muscovites, people who are insiders. Again, you still need these Krupski, right? Russian police, they'll shake down whoever they want to shake down. And when I've seen them at the stopping people at the market, it's not always blacks. They'll take anyone who they think looks like an outsider. It could be a Belarusian or a Moldovan or a Ukrainian. Sometimes they just pick a girl wearing the shortest skirt and stop them. So there's always these kinds of issues of people living outside of the normal system. Now, by the Constitutional Court, Krupiński are eliminated, but of course they still exist. So they still face the same threats and dangers officially. They don't face the same sort of level of potential skinhead violence, although I think there is a sense among Muscovites of being overwhelmed by people coming into the center of the city. But beyond that, I haven't really talked to any person. Yeah.
Yeah, well, at least in Uzbekistan, the Russian colonists called the local Uzbeks black donkeys. So this blackness, you know, is so deeply embedded in the colonial history.
Yeah, yeah.
So we can't talk really much about it as being a new thing. It's been there all along. But my question is the following. How does the established minority population in Moscow and Leningrad regard the newcomers? I mean, you know, Moscow's got 500,000 Tatars, long established there. Practically every nationality has its quarters. So they are identifying themselves as Muscovites, really. But at the same time, they are Kyrgyz, Uzbek, and so on. So how do this older minority residents of Moscow regard the newcomers who happen to be their compatriots?
It varies. A lot of them are resentful. A lot of them think they've spoiled what used to be a good thing, that they used to not have to worry about going outside. And they feel that they made all this effort to assimilate, and now it doesn't matter because they're being identified as outsiders. Others are more sympathetic. They form these national diaspora organizations. But even then, you know, there's a reason why some of these new migrants feel that they're being patronized. It's because they are. I mean, there's a large divide between those who came in the Soviet era and feel like they can help these new migrants find apartments, or if they're not paid, they can try and help to navigate the system. But they often help in a way that's felt by some of these newcomers as patronizing, because the level of education is quite different. The Tatars who have come, I mean, they're probably some of the least likely to be threatened, because the Tatar groups, as you mentioned, are longstanding in Moscow. And of course, Leningrad was completely, of course, destroyed during World War II, and the whole population was rebuilt after that time. And the way Tatars sort of dress and look, they feel at least like they're part of the established population and less likely to again, that Russians think they can, by facial features, not just Russians, I mean, this is Eastern Europeans and Eurasians as well, identify the nationality. And Tatars, they're still part of Russia, and they're considered a little less threatening. But again, everybody has their own sense of what Tatar looks like, or a Caucasus person looks like. you're sort of, it's like playing a lottery, I guess, in a certain extent.
Come to the end of our time, and so if you have any other questions, feel free to come up if our speaker is still available. But thank you. Let's thank Professor Kamadeh for a very stimulating talk. Now I know why, as a Tatar, I feel so uncomfortable in Moscow. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You know, One of the other